Welcome to this Larry Food Series audio cast. This is your host, Pete Kennedy. Today's guest, John Moody, is a man of many talents. John is a farmer, homesteader, manager of a food buyers club, as well as being an author and speaker. He is also a food activist and the co-founder of the Rogue Food Conference. One description of the term Rogue Food is that it refers to ways local food producers and distributors can evade onerous requirements in statute and regulation while remaining in compliance with the law. John lives and farms in Kentucky, a state whose legislators and regulators have not been friendly to the production and distribution of local food. He's going to talk about his run-ins with regulators as well as what people trying to pass local food legislation in Kentucky are up against. In spite of the obstacles, John has been able to build a solid food community in his area and has helped many others do the same throughout the country. We'll talk about the state of the food system since the onset of the COVID crisis and the opportunities that small farmers and homesteaders now have to be successful. Finally, we'll talk about the Rogue Food Conference, an event whose launch in 2020 galvanized many in the local food movement. John will tell us what's in store for the conference in 2021. And one other thing before we start, last but not least, John is a former executive director of the Farm to Consumer Legal Defense Fund and the first executive director of the Legal Defense Fund hat. So without further ado, John, welcome to the audio Solari Food Series audio cast.
Thank you for having me, Pete. It's good to see you.
Yeah, good to see you, even though the listeners aren't going to see us. But so let's just start from the beginning. Most people have a story about how they got into local, discovered local food. What's yours?
Yeah, so I got into local food because the conventional food system almost killed me. You know, so I was in my early 20s, had seasonal allergies so bad that Benadryl sent me free stock options at the end of every year as a patronage dividend. I'd had enough antibiotics by the time I graduated college to qualify as my own CAFO animal operation. And in my early 20s, my already tenuous health just completely began to collapse. So I developed severe digestive issues, including duodenal ulcers that, you know, sent me, it just left me in crippling, debilitating pain all the time. And when I went to a doctor, the only thing the doctor could offer me was pharmaceuticals. And I was finally at a point in my life where I was willing to question, you know, why I was so sick at such a young age, and why were pharmaceuticals the only solution to my problem? And so we started down the rabbit hole of real food and got exposed to the work of Sally Fallon and embraced, you know, traditional foods properly raised and properly prepared. And over the course of about a year, I was able to completely reverse all sorts of significant health issues I was suffering. So I became a true believer pretty quickly in the power of food and thus the importance to have real farmers who know how to raise it.
So that gets on to the next question. You were actually the founder of a buyers club, food buyers club in Kentucky. What led you to start that club up, which is today named the Whole Life Buyers Club?
You know, so we were like your super typical Kroger, Walmart, Sam's Club shopping type folks when Jessica and I first got engaged and then got married. And so we went from shopping at, you know, Kroger and Sam's Club to shopping at Whole Paycheck and Wild Oats, while Wild Oats still existed back in the day. And then we went from, you know, especially like at Whole Paycheck, because I have a background in economics and business finance. You know, I'd walk through the store and I'd see the prices on certain things. And some of the stuff, it's just like organic Cinnamon Toast Crunch. I'm like, yeah, it's organic Cinnamon Toast Crunch. Like, it's still Cinnamon Toast Crunch. This is not good for me. It's not good for anyone. Or I'd be going through the meat aisle and it'd be like, you know, chicken breast, $14 a pound. I'm like, who can afford $14 a pound for chicken breast? I begin to look into some of the data and it's like, wow, it's like I pay $14 a pound and the farmer's getting $1.50 a pound. Like, how does that even work? Well, you know, why is, you know, where's all that money from the $1.50 to $14 going other than into whole paycheck's pocket? And so I wanted to have direct relationships with farmers. And we also started shopping at farmers markets. And then we started getting raw milk directly from a local farmer. And, you know, we're starting to have kids and life was just becoming complicated because it's like, now I have to go to this store for this and I have to go to that store for that. And I have to go to these two different farmers markets. I was like, man, it'd just be so much better if I could get a whole bunch of this stuff in one place. And that was kind of the push to start the buying club. You know, the ability to bring a whole bunch of different companies and farmers to one place and make a market for them, you know, rather than having to chase them all over the countryside when you want stuff from them.
Well, which brings up an important point, just people getting into local food first. I want to know how to get sources. What's a good source? Yeah, how do you vet potential sources of your food? So I guess you had a bigger job. You weren't just vetting for your family. You were vetting for maybe 100 other families. So if you could describe that process and how you're able to separate the wheat from the chaff and get the best producers hooked up with your buying club.
Yeah, so we do farm visits. You know, so all of our farmers either get visited directly by us, or if they go through a local business like Marksberry Farm Market is somebody we now work with. They actually started out as a farm that was supplying our club. And when they saw the amount of demand, you know, our support and other factors allowed them to build their own inspected processing facility that now services, you know, I guess that'd be like Eastern and Central Kentucky. And so if it's farms who are directly sourcing with us, we do phone interviews, we do farm visits. We also ask other farmers who we work with who live close to them about them. You know, we have different auditing tools in place. We ask them where they buy their feed from, you know, because we can then call whoever supplies their feed and make sure that where they're getting their feed is where they say they're getting it from. You know, or if it's going through somebody like Marksberry, they have their own auditing in place to ensure that what they're buying from different farmers is what it says it is. It's definitely one of the bigger challenges has been staying on top of some of our suppliers' practices, because we've noticed that some farms or some companies, as they scale and grow, you know, as they become popular, sometimes they begin to fudge on their sourcing and practices. And so it's an ongoing thing where we're constantly following back up with suppliers, following back up with farmers, and making sure that they're still, you know, headed in good directions and doing things to our standards or higher.
Right. I guess another consideration or just another challenge you have to put up with is just trying to get on the right side of the law, making sure you're in compliance when you're just procuring food or distributing food to your customers. So I'm going to get into a run-in you had in a bit with the Louisville State Department and, I mean, Louisville Metro Health Department and the Kentucky State Department of Health. But first, yeah, if you could just describe, yeah, the challenges you want, because a lot of this quality food isn't easy to get or it's not easy to navigate the legal channels. You have to get it for your Buyers Club members. So if you could describe some of those challenges.
Yeah, well, you know, the reason I set up the club the way I did is to avoid a lot of the legal stuff, you know, so thankfully, some of our farmers are inspected, some of them are not. The farmers really work in a wide variety of ways, you know, just depending on the situation and what our goal with them is and what the product is. But, you know, so much of the structure of our club, since we're basically like, you know, we don't sell things, which is one of the biggest, you know, one of the biggest ways we stay out of the legal crosshairs is the buying club isn't a business and we don't buy and sell things.
Right.
You know, what we've done is we've created a place where people can directly buy from a wide variety of farmers and sources, and we just help facilitate it.
Yeah, we're going to get into, because you're, I think, known as an innovator, someone, you were doing rogue food type maneuvers long before the Rogue Food Conference started up. Yeah, just one example of a rogue food maneuver would be the herd share agreement, where in Kentucky, you can't sell raw milk legally, so you have to find some way you can get it through another type of distribution. So probably the best single response I know of to an enforcement action in our area of work was yours, and it's coming up on 10 years now. So I guess first, if you could describe what a herd share agreement is, and then just go through the events that, really led to an amazing result, considering what you were potentially up against.
Yeah, and so, you know, there's a couple of things I'll mention real quick. There's a lady in Canada who has a hair salon or something. They've had them closed down forever. But in the province of Canada she's in, you can do like interviews in person for podcasts and radio shows and TV and whatever. So she turned her hair salon into an audition place or whatever. It's like brilliant, you know? And this has always been my heart in dealing with when the government is out of control and beyond its bounds is, you know, how do you use their own ridiculous stuff against them? And so, you know, one of the ways we do work with a lot of farmers is we have an ownership stake in the animals we're getting food from. You know, so if we want a farmer to be able to butcher chickens on his farm for us, rather than having to take them 200 miles so they can go through a triple chlorine bleach bath before they hit our tables, you know, we might buy the baby chicks. So there are chickens, and we'll have a labor contract with the farmer to raise our chickens and to butcher our chickens for us, rather than, again, getting away from this buying and selling where so much of the regulation happens. Or for dairy, we have a herd share with the dairies we work with, which basically means we own part of the dairy herd. So we own part of the milk the cows produce, and we pay the farmer to care for our cows and, you know, all of that kind of fun stuff. You know, so it's definitely a game of whack-a-mole, really seeing where you can exploit or take advantage of chinks in the regulatory system while also seeking to change the regulatory system and create more space and roll back all of these unconstitutional and corrupt government agencies and programs.
Well, so start, I guess it was May 2011. If you could go through just the events of this enforcement action and your response to it.
Yeah, so I actually wasn't at the club. I think it was Kane Holbrook who's my co-administrator or co-conspirator, just depending on which word you think fits better. It was his first time running a day of club solo. So it was my first day off, I believe, ever in like, you know, years and years of running the club. So I'm at home out here on our farm and I get a phone call from Kane, and Kane says that the health department is there. And, you know, the health department says they had had some kind of, complaint or report or whatever. You know, the beauty of not getting to face your accusers in the current system of malfeasance. And so the inspector, and, you know, this was, is that Memorial Day weekend?
Yeah, it was Memorial Day weekend.
Yeah. And so, you know, it's a holiday weekend, and you could tell the inspector really didn't want to be there. He was just one of those, I'm just following orders kind of fellows. And so John Mark Hack was also there. And John Mark Hack tried talking some with the inspector unsuccessfully. And Kane talked with him, and I think I might have also talked with him on the phone some. And it ended with the inspector serving us with cease and desist and quarantine orders for the raw milk that the buying club makes available to members. And so that's kind of, you know, probably happened mid-afternoon on a Friday. This is like 2 o'clock, maybe 3 o'clock or so. You know, and at this point we had about 150 families who were members. And, you know, everybody's wondering, what are we going to do? And you know that at this point in time, this is right in the middle of the local food wars, where the government raided Rossum and shut him down, and raided Manna Warehouse in Ohio and shut him down, and raided Athens Locally Grown and got them to cry uncle. You could toss out the names of a number of the farmers.
Right, Vernon Hertzberger, there were several raids on his farm around that time.
Yeah, I think Vernon's court case came after.
Yeah.
But up until our altercation, if I remember correctly, no one had won. It was like this, you know, just brutal streak of government enforcement actions, shutting down farmer after farmer or local food operation after local food operation. And so I'm just sitting there on a Friday night praying, taking counsel with a couple different people I know, and really thinking through, like, you know, my wife was pregnant at the time with our, is that right? Would she, I think she probably was pregnant with Noah. So we have two small kids. I believe Jess was pregnant with Noah. And I'm sitting here thinking, am I really willing to go to jail over the right to choose what I feed my family and myself? And I was like, yeah, I was like, I'm totally willing to do this. Like, this is the line in the sand, you know, but I'm a skinny guy. If I'm going to go to jail, I don't want to be in a cell with Bubba, who's 250 pounds and lots of tattoos. I want to be in a jail cell with Kane or somebody from my food buying club. So if I'm going to go to jail, I'm taking as many people with me as I possibly can. And we basically drew up, you know, a real simple thing that said, you know, I, the undersigned, in accordance with my constitutional and God-given rights, am taking my raw milk from my cows. And if anybody from the health department has a problem with it, they can contact me at the name and phone number below. And so,
just to back up a sec, there was a quarantine order placed on that milk. And what that means is if you violate that quarantine order, that means that milk is not supposed to move anywhere as long as that quarantine order was in effect. I believe it was the State Department of Health who placed that. And then the Louisville Department of Health, I think, sent you a cease and desist. But so you're looking at potential criminal penalties here for violating that quarantine order if anyone removes the milk. So proceed.
Yeah. So it's crazy to think about, you know, that. And so we made this sheet. And I also printed the pertinent sections of the Kentucky Constitution. And we hung those pertinent sections of the Kentucky Constitution next to this sheet members could sign, next to the cease and desist and quarantine orders. And at the same time, then, I emailed all the members of the club because, you know, we have an email group for the club. And I still have that email. And I basically said to the members of the club, you know, you have to make a choice. Like, who chooses what you eat? Is it some unhealthy, overweight health inspector who's in the pocket of big pharma and big food? You know, is it some bureaucrat in Washington, D.C., who's 1,000 miles away? You know, or is this truly a fundamental human right to choose what you eat and who you get it from? You can go to any corner store in Kentucky and get Skittles and cigarettes and 1,000 other foods that we know will make you ill and kill you. If not immediately, surely over time. And are you really going to let them say that you can eat all the crap you want, but we're going to restrict your ability to support local farmers and choose what you feed your family? And so I sent that email and had Kane and them put up the signs. And then I just had to wait and see what the members would do. You know, a big part of winning is building community. And so, especially back in the early 2000s, our buying club was like a giant family, you know, because many of the members joined, you know, right when they were just having kids or just had, you know, so a lot of us went through having our first kids together, sending meals to each other after babies were born, helping each other navigate health issues. So we had a lot of built up community and trust in the buying club membership. And, you know, so sent this email and man, like, I think all but two member families came, broke the quarantine, signed the paper. One of my greatest regrets is, I guess the health department came and took that paper. So I never got to see for myself all the names of our members.
Right.
And so, and people who weren't even members of our club came and broke the quarantine and signed the papers. It was really cool to see just. And so once that started rolling, you know, I wanted to maximize impact. So the first rule of beating the government is make a big target. This is one reason why Vernon was able to eventually prevail in Wisconsin, is because, you know, a bunch of us, you, Max Kane, me, you know, we enlarged his influence and the target he became and the community investment in Vernon to where, you know, it just became, you know, an untenable fight for the Wisconsin DACTAP. So while my members now are breaking this quarantine and stuff, I start thinking through, well, what are we going to do next? What else can we do to really, you know, turn the screws on the Kentucky Health Department? Well, it's Memorial Day weekend. It's a weekend where theoretically people are to pause and remember their family members and fellow countrymen who gave their lives so that we might enjoy freedom. I was like, this writes itself. So I began to contact all of our members and other people. And I said, hey, on Sunday or Monday, because this is back when all the legislators in Kentucky's home phone numbers were on the LRC website.
Yeah, it's amazing.
So you can easily find a legislator's home phone number as long as you can access the internet. I said, hey, on Sunday or Monday, I want you to make just a couple phone calls. Call your state representative, call your state senator. And they're going to be like, why are you calling me on a holiday weekend at home? I was like, I want you to be super kind. Don't at all be belligerent. Just say, hey, like, I don't really want to be bothering you. I understand it's a holiday weekend. But on a holiday weekend, I should be celebrating the freedom I have because of sacrifices my and other people in this nation made. Your health department is threatening me with jail over choosing what I feed my family. And I'm not okay with it. And so we just peppered all of these elected officials with hundreds and hundreds of phone calls and with really good messaging, you know, not a bunch of angry people screaming at them on the phone, but just really, really good focused messaging. So a legislator would really understand, you know, the issue and not be able to wiggle. And so I was told 5 or 6 months later that when the Kentucky state government reopened on Tuesday, it was an absolute circus crap show because all these legislators are ticked off and the health department's been getting all of these calls, both from citizens and legislators who are like, what are you doing? Like, what are you thinking? Like, what on earth? And then I went on some radio shows and stuff the first part of that week. And so I think it was by like Thursday night or Friday, the health department released a statement saying, you know, not apologizing, but saying that they didn't have jurisdiction over us. And it was just a misunderstanding.
Yeah, that's just such a key mark you were able to set right there, because one of the big disputes, is there a distinction between the public and private distribution of food? And so a food like raw milk is easy to, it's legal to consume, but how do you get access to it? You were going through the model where you can, and we're still looking for a court case that says that, but just these kinds of actions can set precedent in themselves, even though they don't take place in the courtroom. So from what I understand, since that day, before 2006, there were enforcement actions against these herd chairs. There was one against Gary Oaks, I think a Kentucky farmer, you know, maybe 5 years before yours happened. But since then, as far as I know, there hasn't been any enforcement action, correct?
Yeah, I mean, from my I think I've heard of one or two farmers receive warning letters for like advertising, you know, and maybe advertising they're selling raw milk rather than advertising they have a herd share or whatnot. But other than that, the health department has moved on to giving everybody B minuses and B pluses and staying in their lane and leaving a lot of these grassroots local food type things alone.
Right. So it just goes to show this kind of action in effect in the meat law, because if you change, you don't necessarily need to pass a law, but if you can change a department's interpretation of the law, which you definitely did, in effect, you create law anyway without going through the legislature. So
yeah,
getting back to the rogue food, you mentioned this briefly earlier, but another way you were able to take action to avoid onerous requirements of what's known as the FDA food code, just where usually or often someone setting up a buyer's club and just having a central distribution point of an agency might say, well, you're selling food to the public, so you need a permit and all the requirements that go with it. But you were able to design this administrator contract, which was able to take it out of the public forum, and also were you'd serve is not really as someone who is distributing food so much as just a pass-through for the farmer and consumer to do business directly. So if you could speak to that.
Yeah, you know, so my background's business finance before I got into other stuff. And, you know, as we talked about years ago, you know, a lot of the legal stuff is predicated on buying and selling. It's when you're buying and selling stuff that you begin to get into their nets and their snares. And I didn't want to buy and sell stuff. So I was like, you know, I want to help people access real food. And I want the farmer to make good money. And I want the food to be affordable for people. And I was like, you know, why don't I basically provide just like an administrative service where, you know, a combination of, you know, Justin Bieber doesn't go to the grocery store usually. He gives somebody his money and that person goes to the grocery store for him. It's like, well, that's kind of how the club works in one way. Members have accounts with the club that they keep money in. And they say to the administrative team, this is what I want you to go get with this money. You know, so we're never using our own money and then selling stuff to people. They're basically handing us their credit card and saying, go get me some grass-fed ground beef. Go get me this. Go get me that. So that's one part of it, you know, and then, you know, the other part, well, that's really, really the big part is just like, you know, where they're prepaying for things and we're just kind of grabbing it for them. And it's all private. There's no sales, you know, there's no sales between me and the members. You know, there's no buying and selling. Members are basically buying things directly from these companies and these farmers. And the club just exists for education and to grease the wheels of making that happen.
Right. Before I forget, I want to go back. Just you talked about building a community with this club. And one of the things the Farm to Consumer Legal Defense Fund is there for is to protect that community. And just forgot to mention earlier, the Legal Defense Fund's name was actually on, I think, the cease and desist letter, the quarantine order that the buyer's club received. So one of the main jobs of Farm to Consumer is to provide a backstop when something like a raid in the Whole Life Buyers Club in Kentucky happened. So yeah, if you could explain how it came about that Farm Consumer actually had their name on a quarantine document.
Yeah, so our club was members. And I guess Kane probably called the hotline and had the inspector speak. I guess it was Gary who was on call that day.
Right, General Counsel Gary Cox. Yep.
Yeah, and so the inspector spoke with Gary. Inspector was unconvinced to walk away. But he added Farm to Consumer to the cease and desist and quarantine, I guess. So I need to go find those. I have them filed somewhere. It's been forever since I looked at them.
Right. Yeah, I just remember I was out in Colorado that weekend. I remember talking with you a number of times all through the holiday. So that's, yeah, one thing Farm to Consumer can provide is just a 24-hour hotline. And yeah, with a lot of these attorneys, if they're gone for the weekend, that's it. But with Farm to Consumer, yeah, I think you spoke with Gary and I throughout that weekend. Okay, so the one part of your battle with Kentucky is just the regulators. Another part, Kentucky is just one of those states that's very difficult to get local food legislation passed. You really have to take the initiative like you've done and others have done outside the legislature. But you did try to pass legislation one year. I guess it was, I think it might have even been the same year as the raid or maybe it was the year after. So
yeah, it's probably 2012 or 2013.
Okay.
You know, because it definitely wasn't the year they raided us.
So
it was partly in response to the raid.
Right. But you could talk about the legislation, because it just seems like this form helps strengthen your views on rogue food, just the experience you had trying to get the legislation passed in the state of Kentucky.
Yeah. So I try and avoid politicians like I try and avoid the plague, you know, because they're highly infectious and deadly. But some friends convinced me to help work on some legislation around food freedom in Kentucky. And so we had a very simple goal. It was a very simple bill. And all the bill said was that if somebody has an ownership interest in an animal, then they can benefit from the animal and what the animal produces without government interference. You know, so if you have an ownership interest in a cow, you could eat the cow and it doesn't have to go through the USDA. If you have an ownership in a milking cow, then you're entitled to milk from that cow. And it's not the government's business because you have an ownership interest in the animal. So it was a tiny, tiny bill, you know, like really nothing earth-shaking or radical. And so we began to work on this bill. Really great state rep by the name of Schickel. It was our lead person on the bill. And as part of our bill, me and Christy Arendt and a few others would trek to Frankfort, Kentucky, and go meet with legislators and other stuff. And, you know, there's that scene in the first Star Wars movie where Obi-Wan Kenobi takes Luke to Tatooine, I think it is. And as they're standing looking over the city, you know, Obi-Wan says, "You'll never see a more wretched hive of Villarian scum," or something, you know, looking down at the city. And that's how I look at Frankfort now after having to go there and just being straight up lied to repeatedly by legislators, or sitting down across from a legislator, would sit down across from them. They would purposely touch their Farm Bureau pin, or they'd hold up a Farm Bureau ring to let you know that, like, they're going to listen to you, but this is actually who they listen to. This is all that matters to them. And it culminated then, John Mark Hack, Christy Arendt, and I had to go to a meeting with other stakeholders. So we drive to the Governor's Office of Agricultural Policy, which ironically, John Mark Hack founded. And behind closed doors, in this private meeting, are people from the dying Kentucky dairy industry. So these people who have all the power over the Kentucky dairy industry, in the course of a little over a decade, turned the Kentucky dairy industry from over 8,000 independent small dairy farms to less than 1,000. So these people have overseen a total and complete disaster in terms of the Kentucky dairy industry, just utter ruin. And they are who we have to sit down and talk with. And so we sit down behind closed doors in this meeting, get through some pleasantries, and they basically look at us and they basically threaten us with physical harm if we do not drop our bill.
Was this Farm Bureau? Was this a representative from Farm Bureau who made the threat, or was it somebody else?
Well, these people were part of the dairy processing.
Okay.
And, you know, maybe the Kentucky Dairy Federation, the KDF, who obviously, you know, they probably are also part of Farm Bureau, you know, but they're all cut from the same cloth. Just this corporatist control of food distribution, you know, because, like, if you want to make money, you make a great product. But if you want to become rich, you want to be PayPal, you know, because how could, you know, if I sell 1,000 chickens, I can only make so much money per chicken. But if I can get a quarter off of every single chicken sold in Kentucky, now I'm a multimillionaire and I don't even have to do the work. And that's why our food system is regulated the way it is, because there are people who want to make tremendous amounts of money with none of the risk and none of the work.
Right. Well, yeah. The amount of money the small farmer has gotten out of this has just shrunk over the years, where the middleman makes far more. But you're talking about poultry. To give you an idea of what a tough state John has to work in, one of the better laws for local food producers is most states let them process up to 20,000 birds a year on their farm without inspection. In Kentucky, you can't do that. All they have is two or three mobile, I think, processing units in the state that aren't mobile at all. They say you have to drive there and process your birds at these mobile units. And there's such a line that it's impractical for most of the farmers in the state. But
yeah, the non-mobile mobile processing has always been a big joke. You know, just Kentucky incompetence in action.
Right. But let's go. I think we've both seen this past year, one of the big, what's turned one of the few good things to come out of this COVID crisis is just a big opportunity, it seems like, for local food producers selling direct to consumers, especially the ones producing meat and to a lesser extent, dairy. You, in addition to work being active in Kentucky, you talk to people all over the country. What have you seen since the COVID crisis as far as farm-to-consumer direct sales?
Oh, it's been crazy. Just like sales, especially last spring and summer, just rocketed. You know, so I know friends who they had, you know, in March and April and May, they'd have single month sales that equaled, you know, half of their previous year.
Right.
It was utter and complete madness. It was just a circus. And so things really, really spiked last spring and summer. They kind of calmed down a little bit in the fall. And one of the problems I warned about is starting to really work its way out in the system, that, you know, there's a lot more people now wanting local meat. They don't want to go into these dystopian grocery stores and be biometrically scanned and have to show a vaccine passport to buy, you know, a chuck roast. So there's a lot of people who still are, you know, trying to keep their money in other places. But now all of us local farmers are running into issues where the butchering capacity and infrastructure for handling this increased demand is struggling to keep up. And so it's, you know, there's definitely our buying club over the past month and a half has picked up 20 new families as members.
Right.
Just, I think I picked up 3 or 4 new members yesterday. And so there's definitely a lot of demand for local food. And you just have to really be creative and work together. And that's one of the other good things I'm seeing is more and more local farmers and more local food clubs and food hubs working together to address product shortages, butchering shortages, moving things around, and really trying to tag team to overcome some of the challenges.
Well, and convince our listeners to join more buyers clubs like you, providing real food. Yeah, it's worth going into what's happening with the conventional industry. I mean, the conventional industry is moving toward a synthetic food system. especially in the area of meat, you have these lab cultured meats. And, you know, I've gone to this food safety conference the last couple of years, and they've had presentations on these lab cultured meats, and these officials are complaining that they can't find the ingredients about what's actually in the meat. And actually, one of the ingredients has been disclosed recently. So if our listeners are sitting down, fetal calf blood will be an ingredient in some or all of these cell cultured meats. There is actually a trade paper called The Milkweed, whose editor, Pete Harden, it's mainly on the dairy industry, but they also cover the meat industry. He's a great investigative reporter, but he had a call from this member who was saying he wanted to purchase these heifers, which were, you know, healthy, very close to giving birth. And he was outbid by, I guess, this private group that this man disclosed was going to use the fetal calf blood for their cell cultured meat. So that's kind of one thing that's going on. The other thing that's going on is it just seems like the meat packers, there are four meat packers in this country, control over 80% of the beef market. I think four control between 60 and 70% of the pork market. One of the things they tried to do, it looks like, was to create these artificial shortages. I mean, back last spring, there were shortages. You know, you speak or communicate with a farmer named Jordan Green, who did an investigation on what actually happened was with pork. Because the meat packers were crying poor mouth, telling the supermarkets they didn't have the supply for them. And so what actually happened there with pork?
Yeah, so Jordan Green, myself, Thomas Massey, you know, we are all poking around our contact networks and other stuff. But basically, as we went into last winter into spring, there was a giant surplus in the industrial meat system. And that's why meat prices had been coming down. You know, so if you go look at forecasted, you know, meat tracking prices and forecasted prices, you know, last winter, meat prices were already trending down and they were looking to go even farther because China and America really had, you know, significant overproduction coming into the pipeline. And so it really looks like that, you know, the meat industry, you know, pulled off a wonderful scam at taxpayer expense, where they artificially butchered off. You know, I think in the pork, the last time I looked into it, which was months ago, they might have culled just in America 20 million pigs.
Yeah, it's just...
So these are 20 million animals that were, you know, butchering size. So if each of those animals yields, let's say, 200 pounds of meat, is that 4 billion pounds? You know, 20 million times 200?
Yeah.
Just an incredible, you know, and they did this in beef to some extent, you know, and so they called all these animals because they said there's no way for them to be butchered. And you can go look at all the financial data. All of these companies reported record profits last year, you know, giant profit. So they called all of these animals saying there's no way to butcher them. They ratcheted up prices a bunch. And then they made record profits while paying farmers even less. And, you know, they're going to get insurance settlements and other government handouts to pay for the lost animals.
Right.
You know, it's a total scam.
I think with meat, what they did too was they cut off, just dropped some of these ranchers supplying beef. Meat packers cut off some of these ranchers supplying beef to them. And while they were doing that, they were, in putting those people out of business, they were importing more beef from Brazil and Argentina. So it almost seemed like they have it set up to where they you know, eventually, as they go towards synthetic meat, they're going to be more reliant on, they want to rely more on imported meat. And then when it gets near the time where they want to just go more towards synthetic meat, just drop the imports down. So the loser in the whole thing is the ranchers. It's kind of like Bill Gates has a partnership with Tyson and Cargill in Memphis Meats to make lab-produced meat. And it almost reminds me of what happened in the dairy industry, where Dean Foods was also selling soy milk and just other nut milks and cutting the legs off of these dairy producers. So,
well, I just posted this yesterday. Bill Gates now as well is in a venture to create synthetic breast milk.
Right.
This just came out, but it's total and complete, you know, and U.S. farmers lose, but U.S. consumers lose as well.
Right.
Because the quality of the food continues to decline, and our communities lose because you're continuing to hollow out rural and, you know, basically anything that's not a city in America suffers as they crush, you know, the economic wheelhouse of the countryside, which is food production.
Right. And just to add on, to pile on here, USDA has plans to eliminate the disclosure requirements on the label for irradiated meat and poultry. So that could be coming up in a year. And yeah, this was at the same food safety conference. This USDA official was saying they're talking to FDA now and trying to convince them to eliminate any radiation disclosure requirement on the labels for, say, some kinds of produce. So they're trying to expand this throughout the food system. So,
yeah, the mainstream food system is just a disaster. You know, like, hopefully your listeners are at least familiar with it some from some of the documentaries and books written. You know, but just look around you. Look up and down the street you live on. And how many people are healthy? How many people have a good, you know, body weight and health? How many people can go an entire calendar year without needing pharmaceuticals? You know, it's just like, you know, on the one hand, you and I, Pete, can talk more technically about all of these kind of more technical problems in the food system. You know, but for people listening, I remember years ago when my wife and I would go to the Louisville Zoo on occasion, because one of our family members would buy us a zoo pass for the family to go to the zoo. And I would go to the zoo and I'm just like, and look at the people walking in and out of the zoo and around the zoo. I'm just like, we are so unhealthy. Like, half of the people are carrying around a half extra person on their person. Like,
right. Yeah. What, I mean, just this move to synthetic food, we know who benefits from this. It's the pharmaceutical companies. If you look at the billions of dollars Bill Gates has in the pharmaceutical industry, this one business is going to help the other the more and more he gets into food. But there is an answer to all this. And you were mentioning just how much your health improved once you started purchasing local food. It's just a tremendous difference. Weston Price has a 50% pledge campaign to convince, just encourage each of their members to buy more than half their food directly from a farmer or local artisan. This campaign was launched over a year ago. What's happened with the food system since, it should really be a lot higher than that number. Because one of the things, just a lot of the Weston Price members say, a lot of them, you know, occasionally get someone who really had a miracle cure, a reversal of disease. They might have had Crohn's disease or something like that, and credit food with a big part of that. But more than anything, it's these people don't take drugs. They don't have to go to doctors. And just with what's happened with the healthcare system over the last year and how in the upheaval it's in, it just seems more critical than ever to go direct to the farm. Yeah, John, just with all this demand for local food and many people who aren't part of the local food movement would really benefit by participating in it. Yeah, just what do you see coming down the pike as far as access for these people wanting this kind of food?
Yeah, it's going to be an interesting year. I warned back in December that there is going to be seed shortages this coming year. Go to any major website that sells seeds like Johnny's, Baker Creek. A lot of them have discontinued orders already for spring. And so there's more people getting into farming, more people getting into growing food. And it's going to be a bit bumpy as, you know, the demand and all of the new producers and all of the supply chains have to adjust to a different food economy. You know, so look for local people you can support. There's still lots of them out there. And when you have opportunity to help them make changes at the state level to make their life easier, please lend a hand.
Right. Yeah. And just in the area of meat, like we've spoken about, just a bill that really could have helped the meat supply in this country would have been the Prime Act, where if you're a custom facility, you would have been allowed to have, someone would be allowed to use the custom facility and sell meat by the cut from that facility. We saw what happened, that the Prime Act has been in before Congress for the last three sessions. They had over double, between two and three amount times the number of sponsors that they did in the prior sessions. But what I saw the opponents do is they kept introducing these other bills, a bill to improve state meat inspection, a bill to allowing state inspected meat to go over state lines, which is a good bill, but it doesn't do nearly as good as much as the Prime Act did. And in the end, from what I understand, they included a bill in the last stimulus package called the Ramp Up Act, which provides maybe $60 to $80 million worth of grants for these slaughterhouses that are existing, I guess, mainly. And that's not what we need. We need more slaughterhouses. And it just seems like this is another opportunity for rogue food to come into play here. The USDA does have this regulation called the personal use exemption, where according to their interpretation, someone can actually raise cattle on their own property, sell that cattle, have the owners come onto that farmer's property, slaughter and butcher the animal. As long as the farmer who raised the animal doesn't take part in the slaughtering and butchering, that can be done without inspection, really without much regulation at all on the property. So that is potentially another area the rogue food movement can go. Which brings us to the rogue food conference that you created with Joel Sadlin last year. You were the manager, just a tremendous response from that. So what was the inspiration for the conference? When you were first starting out, in your mind, what was the purpose for the conference?
Well, Joel approached me 3 or 4 years ago. We were having lunch somewhere. And Joel said, I want a conference. Joel's like, I wish I could go to a conference where people would teach circumvention in how to beat the government instead of how to get along and comply. And I'm like, that sounds like a dream, Joel. I was like, nobody's going to put on this conference. And Joel's like, we'll put on this conference because I want to go to this conference. So we'll make this conference happen. But at the time, he was super busy. So it was like an idea that sat on the back burner between us for a couple years. And then, you know, the first one was January of last year. So it was probably January of the year before, so 2019, you know, Joel sent me a message and said, hey, I'm finally ready to help make this happen. So let's have a rogue food conference, a conference that is all about circumvention and innovation rather than compliance. So that was the basic inspiration, is wanting to highlight innovative circumvention solutions to government-created problems in food. And that's what we ran with. We had, you were there. We had all of these amazing, absolutely crazy people from across the country. People doing food churches, people doing community pantry type things, you know, just so many different, you know, interesting folks really trying to, you know, work around and stay out of the crosshairs that make it so hard to do real local food.
Right. And this isn't violating the law. This is just to find creative ways to avoid some of the more onerous requirements of the law while being able and using those ways to be able to make a living, which so many of these one-size-fits-all requirements in the law prevent the farmers and local artisans from doing. Just one impression I had from that conference was, it seemed like a lot of people after that conference just had the feeling that I'm not alone. You know, I have other, there are other farmers around the country who are in the same boat I am. They're looking for creative solutions and still being able to stay on the right side of the law. You know, there's a local community and there's a kind of a national local food community. And this really seemed to jumpstart the national community.
Yeah, you know, it's great. A lot of people were encouraged that there are people who have solutions, or they were inspired to start working on their own solutions. And yeah, I was just blown away by how encouraged attendees were by the event. And so for this year, we're slated to do two more. We're going to do one down in Tennessee. You know, probably June 5th is the tentative date for that one. And then we're going to do one at Polyface, most likely in August, though I'm waiting for Joel to get back to me about locking that date down and knowing that that's when it's going to happen. And, you know, the legal issue is tough because, as you and I both know, like, so many things that are illegal, it's just a matter of some bureaucrat's interpretation. You know, there's not an actual law. There's some government agency who says it's wrong, even though there's no law to support it at times.
Right. And that's where the strength in numbers comes in. I think the more people are doing this, just the more governments are less likely to strike back. I mean, at one time, you know, during when either farms or buyers clubs such as yours were being raided, there were more actions against raw milk. There's still occasionally actions, but it's gone away quite a bit just because I think of the growth of the number of farmers producing raw milk, number of people consuming it in the country. And the truth is, the one argument the government has always used against people selling food locally without regulation is the food safety argument. But when you look at the mess the industrial system is in now, they have these long supply chains. I mean, food, that's unregulated might be coming in from 10,000 miles away into this country, unregulated seafood or things like that. And they don't, the industrial system does not have the food safety argument. The local food system has it. And when you take that argument away from the industrial system and give it to the local system, there's nothing in favor of the industrial system anymore. The more money stays in the community with a local food system. The producers make a better living in the local food system. The public health improves when members of the community are buying more of their food direct from the farm. So one of the things that has come out, I think, of this COVID crisis and the unshake and just the upheaval in the conventional system is that I think there might be as many as 7 food freedom bills before the legislature this session in different states. You know, most of them probably won't pass, but there might be 1 or 2 that do. And one of the more amazing stories is that the governor of South Dakota is, her office is supporting the food freedom bill before it even gets to the legislature.
Oh, that's great.
And it's just, yeah, it's just trying to work with people who want the same thing on the bill. So even though you need the rogue food system to maneuver over the existing law, it looks like there's a real chance now to change the law in major ways, allowing unregulated local producers selling direct to consumers. Just the more of those you have, the healthier the food system you're going to have and more self-sufficient than local and regional food production you're going to have. So it's really, in spite of all the trouble that's going on now, there's really a lot of opportunity for the local food movement. But John, I want to finish up by just getting, if people are interested in finding out more about the Rogue Food Conference, about your consulting services, you consult with people around the country on forming and operating a food buyers club, where can they go to contact you?
Yeah, so Rogue Food Conference is roguefoodconference.com. And my personal website is johnwmoody.com.
Okay. And yeah, there's a lot going on in the area of homesteading. We'll try and make that a separate broadcast to meet the interest out there for knowledge about that. And John, appreciate you taking the time for the broadcast. Continued success.
Great. Well, it's good to see you.
Yes.
But I really can't wait to see you, hopefully in person, in a couple months at the next conference.
Looking forward to it. Rogue Food in Tennessee in May.
Yep.
Be there. All right. Take care, John.